This is Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Jack Wright. We are in the interview room of the Southwest Collection Special Collections Library. It's December 17th, 2002. We're on the campus of Texas Tech University, Lubbock, Texas. And Mr. Wright, let's start with a brief biographical sketch. Tell me when and where you were born.
Okay, I was born in, by the way, the official name is Jackie V, which stands for Vernon, Jackie V. Wright.
Okay.
And I go by Jack Wright.
Okay.
I've been called a lot. I was born in Jefferson County, Oklahoma, on September the 14th, 1936.
Okay.
Born at home.
Uh-huh.
I might say I'm kind of lucky to be here because I was born with yellow jaundice.
Really?
But I managed to get through that. My father was, well, we were poor folks. And born during the Depression. That my mother and father had moved over into Oklahoma. They were from Texas. They had moved over there to try to find work. Dad was working in the fields. Moved back to Texas shortly after my birth. My first memories are living on a farm out north of Electra, Texas.
Okay.
And we weren't even sharecroppers. Dad was working the farm for a man named Al Robb, who lived in Electra.
Mm-hmm.
And he was making $30 a month.
Wow.
But we had a good life. My memories when I'm 3-4 years old, vague, but it was a good life. And as World War II came along, am I getting ahead of you?
Not at all.
As World War II came along, I have an older sister and a younger brother.
Okay.
Actually, my mother's first two children were twins, and they died in infancy within hours after their birth.
Okay.
But that's how the children were back then. The doctor was there and said, those kids are all right. He left. One of them lived an hour and a half, and the other one lived 2 hours.
They born at home as well?
Pardon me?
Were they born at home?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. My younger brother was the only one that was born in a hospital. He was born in a little hospital in Electra, Texas.
Okay.
My sister was born in 1935, January of 35, me in September of 36, and then my younger brother was born in December of 41.
Okay.
So as World War II came along, I don't know my dad's feelings toward should I go into the military or not? I know Dad was very strong on taking care of his family.
Mm-hmm.
His family was so important to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was trying to take care of his family. He wasn't trying to find a job to get out of the military, I don't think.
Right.
But he happened to get that job.
Okay.
In probably late 1941, Dad got a job with Firestone Rubber Company.
Okay.
In San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we lost our rubber supply when the Philippines fell.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rubber makers went to developing the synthetic rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Firestone was doing. Dad was driving a truck. They put these various formulas for synthetic rubber on these trucks, and they were driving. They were driving trucks 24 hours a day, Firestone.
Mm-hmm.
So the people that were working for Firestone were exempt from the draft.
Because they were contributing to the war effort.
They were contributing to the war.
Okay.
So Dad worked during the war, throughout the war years, and I first started the school in a little town south of San Antonio called Somerset.
Okay.
And only, I didn't complete my first year there, and then we moved into San Antonio, and I completed my first year of schooling in San Antonio and started my second.
Okay.
Well, by this time, the war was winding down, mm-hmm. and the job was winding down,
mm-hmm.
and so Dad sent the family back to Burke Burnett, actually, my mother's parents.
Okay.
And we lived with them for a few months until Dad's job wound down and he went into the oil field then.
Okay.
And Dad was just a laborer. Dad had eighth grade education. Again, the family was the important thing.
Do you remember anything about World War II? Do you have any memories? of the war?
No.
Because you were
not
five,
really.
4, 5, 6 years old.
Yeah. Not, you know, I remember it being there.
Right.
And that's, I had an uncle, dad's next older brother, mm-hmm. Was drafted in the Navy, mm-hmm. and this was, I believe, a draft board thing. The elector draft board drafted my uncle into the Navy. He was 35 years old. He had 4 children. He had a bad back.
Hmm.
And he was drafted in the Navy, sent to San Diego, went through the basic training, and never left San Diego. He was discharged from the Navy after the war ended in San Diego.
Wow.
And it really cost the government. He had bad teeth. They had to pull his teeth and make him false teeth. He had to operate on his back. He was a supply clerk. But I don't believe that that the draft board was really looking closely at what was going on.
Probably not.
But anyway, I really didn't have any relatives in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The first relative that was in any service, I can go back to a great grandfather Wright. Never knew him, but he was in the Civil War.
Okay.
I've got a picture of him mm-hmm. with in his Union uniform mm-hmm. with crossed pistols across like this across his vest. That's all I know of great granddaddy Nathan Wright.
What a great picture.
Yeah. I've made copies of that and given it to all my children.
Uh-huh. Okay. So tell me about your schooling. What do you remember most about going to school?
Playing. Having fun.
Mm-hmm.
In the early years, when I went to Burke Burnett in the second grade,
mm-hmm.
finished out the second grade there, then when Dad moved back, we moved out between Electra and Burke Burnett in the oil field, a place called the Hershey Field.
Okay.
And I went into the Electra School District for the third grade.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a little country school called Sunshine Hill. Mm-hmm. A little 3-room schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
A man and wife, school teachers, lived in a house right there. And they were just 2 teachers. She taught the 1st, 2nd, 3rd grade in one room. And he taught the 4th, 5th, and 6th grade in the other room. Mm-hmm. And then when you went into the 7th grade, you went into Electra.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we went there for the 3rd grade. And then during the summer, between the 3rd and 4th grade, we moved back into the Burke Burnett School District. So they put me right back in with the kids I was with in the 2nd grade. So I knew them in the 2nd grade and picked them up in the 4th grade. Went all the way through school, graduated from Burke Burnett school system in 1955.
Okay.
And fall of 55, went into then Midwestern University. Wasn't state supported then. Actually, it was 2 schools in one. There was Hardin Junior College mm-hmm. that was state supported, and then Midwestern University, which was the final 2 years, and it was not state supported.
Mm-hmm.
So, sometime between the time I graduated in 1960 to whenever the whole school then became combined and became Midwestern State University.
Okay. Before we get into your college years. What do you remember most about high school? Were you a good student in high school?
Yes, matter of fact, I graduated 3rd in my class.
Mm-hmm.
Football was very important to me.
Yeah.
I played high school football. Uh-huh. I was a 4-year letterman.
What position did you play?
Well, I started out playing guard and end, defensive end and offensive end, and then. That's what I played. I played more defensive end than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But when injuries would occur, I could play either right or left guard. I could play right or left end. As a matter of fact, I was more of a left end than a right end, but I scored my first touchdown playing right end.
Okay.
Caught a pass and jumped into the end zone.
Great.
Oh, it was
good. What were your favorite subjects?
Math. I loved math in high school,
mm-hmm.
but it ate my sack lunch in college.
Okay. Tell me about your family. You know, growing up through high school, did you have a close? Were you guys close or not?
The family was generally close. My younger brother and I, we knocked heads a lot. He mm-hmm. was about four years younger than me, and he had a stubborn streak. He like his father, and so we knocked heads a lot. A problem that you have in a small school system like Burke Burnett. My younger brother came along and had some of the same teachers that I had.
Right.
And I was a good boy. Mm-hmm. I loved to be a teacher's pet. Mm-hmm. I was most of the time. But anyway, he was rambunctious, you know, and he had some problems. And the teachers were saying, "Why can't you be like your brother?" Oh, me, and that caused some problems. Mm-hmm. But generally, yeah, as young kids, I can remember we lived out in the country until I was a junior in high school.
Okay.
We still had the old outdoor bathroom, latrine.
Really?
Until I was, you know, we finally moved to town in 1953, and boy, we were really in high cotton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't any television. We listened to ball games on the radio. Every evening at about supper time, about 6, there was the top 10 tunes, mm-hmm. music of the day. Mm-hmm. We had listened to that.
Okay.
One of the top 10 was Bob Monroe's Mule Train. I don't know if you've heard that. But that goes way on back. But anyway, we would do that. We would have our dinner meal. We called it supper. Mm-hmm. As a family, there's times we'd mom would pop up a bunch of popcorn and we'd sit around and play bingo or Monopoly or those kind of games as a family. Mm-hmm. I can remember those kind of things.
Okay.
As you know, the joys of being. With the family.
Mm-hmm. Did you work when you were a little older in high school?
Yes. I started working in a grocery store, I guess when I was a freshman in high school. And I worked in the grocery store probably until my freshman and sophomore year, of course, part-time. Mm-hmm. And then I moved into a service station.
Okay.
And worked in a service station. And this was back during the days of a service station.
Right.
It wasn't just a gas pump. We filled the cars up with gas. I washed cars, greased cars, changed oil, fixed flats.
Mm-hmm.
And brother, they didn't have all this power equipment you got today. it was tough. But I did that basically all through high school and. I managed when I graduated and before I went into college,
mm-hmm.
My dad worked at this time was working for what was then Magnolia Petroleum Company, which mm-hmm. later became Mobil Oil Company.
Mm-hmm.
Magnolia had a schoolboy summer program, and they would hire primarily children of employees, and I managed to get in that program. So I worked during the summer for Magnolia, and Magnolia paid top wage.
Really?
We were no different from the older hands. You know, if they were hired at the same time we made the same wage.
Mm-hmm.
Because we only worked during the summer period,
mm-hmm.
and that paid for most of my college.
Good. Did your parents emphasize education to you? Did you think you were going to go to college? Did you have a personal desire, or were they saying, you know, Jack, you're going to go to college?
No, it was. I cannot remember my parents urging me to go on. It was very subtle, if it was.
Okay.
It was, I'm going to go to college.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, at way back when I was in junior high and high school, a high school diploma was about all you needed. By this time, it was a college degree. You
mm-hmm.
needed a degree, and of course, it's gone on from there to, mm-hmm. to the master's, to the doctorate. To
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell me about what you remember about college. You started at Hardin Junior College.
Yes.
Okay. What do you remember about college?
Okay, first of all, I did get a scholarship
okay.
that paid tuition, books, and fees to the junior college.
Okay, was it an academic scholarship?
No, it was just an individual scholarship.
Just an individual scholarship. Okay.
Individual scholarship, which helped a lot. And then my summer employment helped pay the rest of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
I lived at home during the first semester, but I went to my dad and said, "Dad, is there any way I could move into the dorms? And those guys have so much fun."
Mm-hmm.
So Dad worked out, and you could live in the dorm
mm-hmm.
for about $35 a month.
Okay.
Now you didn't have to eat in the cafeteria, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The programs have changed since then, but I moved into the dorm then, second semester of my freshman year. College work was tough. Learning does not come easy to me. It did in high school, but when I got into college, I had to really hit the books and work hard. And yet, we still had a lot of fun.
Okay. Were you a good student?
Yeah, I was a good student. I just had trouble learning.
Okay.
I enjoyed freshman sophomore work. I never will forget one of my English professors. Barton was his name. English literature. And we were reading and discussing in class the novel Return of the Native.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of that one?
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember Mr. Barton was a lieutenant colonel in the National Guard.
Okay.
We called him Colonel Barton, but he was talking about the various ironies in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And just a lot of times, I would take issue with him. I would speak up. Mm-hmm. Basically, the only one in the class that would counter him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I was absent, and someone told me this. Mr. Wright, no competition today. Yeah, I was a good student. Probably didn't study as hard as I thought I did.
Mm-hmm.
But, I managed to make mostly B's, a few A's, and some C's, and two D's.
What were your favorite subjects? What did you get the two B's in?
Calculus.
Okay.
Both of them. Differential calculus and integral calculus.
Okay.
And I will always believe that, and it was the same teacher in both courses, and he also taught trigonometry. Now, I never did take any trig in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But he believed in open book tests. And I never did learn trig. Because on one of the final exams in trig, he took one of the example problems right out of the book and put it on the test.
And it was right there in the book.
So you opened it up and copied it down.
Mm. Okay.
Bless his heart, he was a fine man, but
uh-huh.
I didn't learn trig, and without trig, you get into calculus, you're lost, and I was lost, and I made D's because he didn't want to give me F's.
Okay.
But that's the two lowest grades I had.
What subjects did you enjoy the most?
Well, I majored in geology. I enjoyed one of the freshman courses, historical geology.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that, and then went on. I enjoyed the geology courses a lot.
Okay. Did you have aspirations to be a geologist?
Yes.
When you graduated?
That's my major.
Okay.
I've got a Bachelor of Science degree in geology and a minor in math.
Okay.
And now I never worked a day in geology. I can't even spell it now.
So you went to school from 55 to 59, is that right?
Actually, I crammed a four-year course into 4.5 years.
Okay. Okay. So
ROTC was, in a state-supported school in those days, Hardin Junior College,
uh-huh.
ROTC was a requirement.
Okay.
Freshmen and sophomore boys had to take ROTC.
Uh-huh.
So I enjoyed ROTC. Of course, went in the first 2 years, and because of the world situation that we were facing at that time, I decided, well, I'm going to go ahead and apply for the advanced courses, the advanced ROTC. If I've got to go into service, it looks like that's what's going to happen anyway, might as well go in as an officer. I applied, was accepted, and went through the last 2 years of ROTC and was commissioned. And the ROTC...
Army ROTC? Okay.
Yes. The ROTC courses and some of the courses that I needed for my degree conflicted. So, and then I got married between my junior and senior year, too.
Okay.
So I had to back off a little bit, and it took me until an extra semester to go ahead and complete my degree.
Okay.
All of the requirements.
So you decided to go from college into the military based on getting commissioned and,
yes.
and going the full route.
Yes. Okay. That, it wasn't my decision. That's the way it was. Once you graduated, you either went into the military or you had to get a deferment for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
I was ready to go.
Okay. All right. So what did your family think about you going into the military?
See, I was married by this time.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife thought, that's fine, we'll go.
Okay.
We had a child also.
Mm-hmm.
Our first son was born in 59. We were married in 58. And we were born in 59.
Okay.
And we went away. My mother was a little upset because her son, her oldest son, was going to be gone. Went to Fort Benning, Georgia. I was commissioned in the infantry.
Okay.
And I had to go to Fort Benning, Georgia for the infantry officer's basic course.
Right, right.
And
tell me about that.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. We played soldier. We had a lot of physical training,
mm-hmm.
tactical training, classroom training. Trying to make officers out of it.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember most about basic training?
The long hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you we were taught then that you belong to the Army. 24 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So you work from candle cane, whatever. Most of it was long days,
mm-hmm.
and then you had to, just like in the old cavalry days, when you got through with the day's work, you had to take care of the horse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you get through the day's work, you got to clean your weapon, and then go home and clean up your boots and spit shine your boots for the
mm-hmm.
next day, and you put all this together, and it doesn't leave a lot of a family life.
Right.
But we adjusted to it.
Did you live with your wife there, or did you
yeah.
have to live on base separately? You lived
no.
together with her?
Yeah.
Okay.
We couldn't get on base because there wasn't base housing for students.
Okay.
So we lived in an apartment off base.
Okay. Were you able to adapt to that military lifestyle, okay? Kind of the regimented lifestyle?
Yes and no. Yes, after a time.
Mm-hmm.
As a second lieutenant... went from there, after I finished the basic course, we went to Fort Rucker, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
which was the Army flight school. I went to flight school.
Okay.
And decided that wasn't, I didn't want to fly. So when I resigned, got out of flight school, and went to Fort Riley, Kansas,
mm-hmm.
as the in the 1st Infantry Division. We were preparing to go to Korea. And this was in 1961, and at this time the Berlin crisis came up, the Cuban crisis, primarily the Cuban crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We got involved in, the 1st Infantry Division was scheduled to be the second American unit to hit the beach in Cuba if we invaded Cuba. The Marines were going first, and we were right behind. We started out with basic trainings. Basic training is normally 8 weeks. We condensed that down to 6 weeks. Advanced individual training, which is the next course for the trainees, is 8 weeks. We condensed that into 5 weeks.
Okay.
And then it was just catch as catch can, basic unit training, advanced unit
mm-hmm.
training, advanced unit training, army training test. It was really, really tough. We got all that behind us. The Cuban crisis went away, and we my wife, her name is Gail, G-A-Y-L-E. We talked and said, no, maybe this is not for us. Maybe it's time for us to get out. Now, I was commissioned in the regular Army. You've got a regular Army commission and a reserve commission. As a reservist, you were committed to 2 years active duty and 6 years reserve time. If you accepted the regular Army commission, which I did, you were committed to 3 years minimum, and then if you resigned, you had no reserve time.
Okay.
I said, hey, we've got 3 years in. I can resign my commission. Let's get out and go back to school and get a teaching certificate and teach school. Okay. Here come orders to Germany. Oh, wait a minute. Let's talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when will we ever get a chance to see you?
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to stay.
Okay.
We went to Germany. That's a 3 year tour. We went over together.
This is in 1963?
1963.
Okay.
We managed to get concurrent travel. Went over on a boat ship called the USNS Geiger.
Mm-hmm.
Heard later it had sunk about three times. It was a unique experience. We kind of wanted to go over by boat, but then when we finished the tour, we wanted to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by this time, I was first lieutenant, and got into Germany, got into the unit, 3rd Armored Division, and was promoted to captain, and I got a command, company command.
Okay.
And that was the turning point. That's when I said, hey, this is the life for me.
Why did you think
that? I loved command.
What did you like about it?
Feeling of power.
Mm-hmm.
I am the company commander. I give the orders. You listen to me, Sergeant. You, Private, have screwed up, and I'm going to take 14 days pay away from you. You're going to have to perform extra duty for 14 days. I'm going to reduce you one rank. There's nothing to compare with being a company commander. Even higher level commands don't compare with being that company commander.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like I said, that won me over.
Were you a good leader, do you think?
Yes, I was an excellent leader. I love my men, and yet I demanded perfection, if you will. I said, you give me your best. If your best doesn't quite add up, I'll accept that as long as you're giving me your best. And then I would take care of my men. I really believe that. I really feel strongly that I took care of my men. But if you screwed up, man, I could come down hard. I never will forget John S. Miracle, one of my troops,
in Germany.
In Germany. He was in my company.
Mm-hmm.
John had went to Germany, I think, as an E-4. And when I knew him, he was an E-1. He had been busted all the way down. John had got a taste of the German nightlife, and he loved it. And so he'd just come and go as he pleased. If he wanted to take off and be gone for 3 or 4 days, a week, 10 days, he'd just go. And what could you do to him? He was already at E-nothing. Couldn't reduce him any further. And so one day I got John back. He came back in, and I said, John, you're not going to go AWOL again. I had his platoon sergeant there. Sergeant, I want you to go up and inventory all of his military clothing, put them in a duffel bag, lock them up in the supply room, leave him one set of fatigues in his underwear. You will inventory all of his civilian clothing, put it in a duffel bag, lock it up in the supply room. And after the evening meal, the charge of quarters is then required, and we put special notice in the charge of court instruction. He goes and gets John's set of fatigues. And John has to run around the barracks in his underwear. And just before breakfast the next morning, the charge of court gives him back a set of fatigues.
Mm-hmm. So that kept him on base.
That kept him there. But he went to the inspector general. Now, if a troop wants to go see the IG, there's nothing you can do. Mm-hmm. You've got to let him go. Well, the IG was located in Frankfurt, Germany. And where we were located is about 35 miles north of Frankfurt.
Mm-hmm.
Lived in a little town called Bootspark. But I could hear the IG scream all the way from Frankfurt, "You can't do that."
Talking to you.
Talking to me.
Uh-huh.
"You can't do that." I said, "Sir, I did." "You can't do that." "Sir," he was a major and I was captain. "Sir, he didn't go AWOL." "You can't do that." "Okay." So I gave him back his clothes. Brought him in. I said, "John, you beat me this time. What are you going to do now?" He said, "Sir, I ain't going AWOL no more." He didn't have about 6-8 weeks left before he rotated back to the States and got out of the service. But he never went AWOL.
See, he learned.
He learned I meant what I said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he didn't go.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question going back to your basic and then going to Fort Rucker. Why didn't you choose to go into flying? You said you didn't want to do that. Why not?
I finished the basic flying course. I soloed. I flew. You know, I could fly by myself.
Mm-hmm.
But it just didn't sit right with me.
Why not?
I don't know. That's one of those things that it just a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't want to fly anymore.
Okay. You felt like you could do more for the Army or on the ground, or was it safer for you on the ground? Or
I can't answer that. I just don't know. I just didn't want to fly. Did I want to be an infantryman rather than an aviator? I don't know. I just didn't want to fly.
Okay.
That's as far as you. I made that decision on my own. One of the first and last that I ever did. Didn't even talk to my wife about it. I just went in one day and said, "I don't want to fly."
And they respected that decision.
Well, I had to go before a board of officers, and I told them, I said, I haven't, the past few weeks, I have not enjoyed flying. I don't want to fly. Oh, okay.
So no problem.
No problem.
Okay.
Then they assigned me to Fort Riley.
Okay. What kind of weapons training did you have at Fort Rucker, or I guess Fort Benning, Rucker?
Fort Benning, we were trained on the M1 rifle then, which was the basic rifle. M1, M2 carbine, the difference in the M1 and M2 carbine, the M1 is semi-automatic. The M2 has a selector switch. It can be fired full automatic.
Okay.
That's the only difference in the two weapons. The .45 caliber pistol, mm-hmm. We fired machine guns. We did some practice with the 106 millimeter recoilless rifle. We never qualified in that weapon, but they had a sub-caliber device that the 106 millimeter recoilless rifle, the main gun, and then a spotter rifle on top of it, and you would fire at your target with the spotter rifle, and it had a phosphorus round in it, mm-hmm. and when you see that you hit the target with that spotter rifle, all you had to do was push. You pull to fire the spotter rifle and push,
mm-hmm.
and that main round was gone. And when it hit, when you saw that white puff of smoke, the main round was right behind it.
Okay. Which was your favorite weapon through all your training? What did you feel most comfortable with?
Well, I love shooting the machine gun. Of course, that was never a weapon that I could. An officer didn't shoot the machine gun,
right?
But I love shooting that old 30 caliber machine gun.
Okay. Were you pretty good with weapons? Did you feel comfortable?
I felt comfortable with them. It wasn't anything exceptional with the weapon. I wasn't I wasn't a crack shot. I fired. Let's see. How did it go? Marksman was the lowest sharpshooter expert.
Mm-hmm.
I fired. Sharpshooter with the M1 rifle, And really, I think that's the only weapon qualified. Okay. The rest of it was familiarization fire.
Okay. Looking back at your training, do you feel like you received adequate training, or poor, or fair, or excellent? How would you rate it?
Adequate to excellent.
Okay.
You had real good instructors, and they did a good job. They were well trained to be instructors.
Mm-hmm.
It was primarily non-commissioned officer instructing. I'll say wannabe officers, even though we were commissioned second lieutenants. But they did a real fine job.
Okay. Do you think, looking back, they could have done anything better, differently for you once you got overseas and once you got into Vietnam?
Yeah, there was one thing prior to Vietnam. Okay, after Germany, mm-hmm. I came back and went to the Infantry Officers Career Course. I was
right.
a captain.
Right.
And went to the Career Course.
This is at Fort Benning.
At Fort Benning.
1966.
Yeah. There was about 200 students in my class, and there were two categories of students: those that just got back from Vietnam and those that were going to Vietnam.
So
I fit into the second category.
Did you know you were going?
Yeah.
You felt pretty certain?
Yeah, no doubt about it. That's where I was going. And there were several things. I'll get back to the weapons in just a minute.
Sure.
The instructors, a lot of the instructors, and this got so low. Pay attention, gentlemen, because this instruction could save your life. We got so tired of that. after we completed the career course, then those of us that were going to Vietnam, they took us out to a range and gave us an M2 carbine.
Mm-hmm.
And we want you to zero this carbine. And we fired on a 1,000-inch range, and it took about 9 rounds to zero that carbine. Okay, now put the carbine over here, and we'll go over to another range and get another carbine that you've never had in your hands before and fire for qualification. Okay, fine, now you've qualified with the carbine. You put it down, and we'll send you to... send you to Vietnam and give you another weapon when you get over there.
A different weapon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a carbine, but it's a different weapon. Uh-huh. You've never fired it.
Right.
And every man, zero is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
You accept the windage and elevation, and you see it a little differently than I see
mm-hmm.
it. But the waste of time of having a zero one weapon, qualify with another weapon, and then pick up a third weapon when we got to Vietnam. Wait till we get to Vietnam, let's do it over there. Either that or issue us that weapon and let us take it with us. But you couldn't do that because you were firing it and flying on civilian aircraft.
Mm-hmm. So that was a problem once you were saying...
It bothered me. I don't think it was a real problem. It just bothered me. It seemed like it's a waste of time.
Okay. Anything else about the training? You said it was fair or... good to excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Were these instructors World War II vets, Korean vets?
Were some of each.
Okay.
And some Vietnam veterans.
What do the Vietnam veterans specifically, what do they tell you about Vietnam and about preparations for going there?
The thing that I remember most about the how to function in Vietnam mm-hmm. is don't set a pattern.
Okay.
You've got to vary the things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do the same thing every day, every week at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets away from me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did that. And a sniper picked out the American advisor. He didn't pick out Jack Wright. He picked out the American advisor. And shot at me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time I ever fired shot anger.
Mm-hmm.
But I was angry because that turkey shot at me twice.
Mm-hmm.
And I shot at him 16 times. I never did see him.
Right.
Never did see him. He was out across a rice paddy and about 300 meters out in a wood line. And I had an M16 rifle this time. It was one we took away from the VC. That's the only M16 rifle I saw in Vietnam was one we took away from the VC.
Huh.
Anyway, I had it laying across my lap, and I flipped that thing on semi-automatic, was firing left-handed. I'm a right-handed shooter. Mm-hmm. I'm right-handed shooter. And I went to shoot. And I mean, I was shooting all the way out. Mm-hmm. And I shot 16 times.
You don't know if you hit him, though.
No, I didn't hit him.
Probably scared him, though.
Yeah. I was, my assistant was driving, and we were in a Jeep. And this was my mistake. When I got in country and went down to my district, and here was my Jeep with a top on it, and I said, wait a minute. You don't have a top on a Jeep in combat. I'd been taught this all my career. You know, take that top off. Well, of course, my people there, the major has spoken, mm-hmm. and so they took the top off. Now, the Vietnamese had to top off their Jeep. And we had the same kind of Jeep today. Mm-hmm. It took a while in Wadong District mm-hmm. for the guerrillas, and that was our primary enemy at that time, mm-hmm. to realize that Jeep without the top on it was the American advisors. And when we were traveling down, we were down here in Thon Nhat Village, mm-hmm. Driving down a wide rice paddy dack is what it was. And there were several Vietnamese jeeps in front of me and mm-hmm. behind me.
Mm-hmm. They could easily see yours.
But they knew exactly who was in that jeep without the top. You know what I did as soon as we got back?
Took the tops off the
put
other jeeps.
Put the top on my jeep.
Put the top on your jeep.
Yeah, I couldn't make them take their top off.
Right.
But here, you know, during the rainy season, we'd be out there and we'd be sitting there in my Jeep getting soaking wet with it and me sitting there with their tops on. And I didn't have sense enough to say, wait a minute. Training. That's the way I had been trained. Mm-hmm. So I did the things that I'd been trained to do, mm-hmm. except I forgot that set of pattern.
You forgot to set a pattern?
I forgot to not
okay.
set a pattern.
Okay.
When I set the pattern of taking that top off, mm-hmm. and my Jeep running around without a top on it, it was clear mm-hmm. who was in that Jeep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Before you went to Vietnam, how much did you know about American foreign policy and what the United States was trying to do in Vietnam?
Very little.
Is that by choice or just by basically your lifestyle?
It's just lifestyle. Okay. I'd heard about Vietnam. My company commander in Fort Riley, Kansas, mm-hmm. Wanted to go to Vietnam. Of course, at this stage, it was still in an advisory capacity.
Right. And that was 61 to 63.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to go. Then I began to hear various things. And then, of course, while I was in Germany in 65 and 66, it really began to heat up in Vietnam.
Yes.
I didn't know whether I would be sent to Vietnam before the career course or after the career course.
Okay.
But as the Lord would have it, it was after the career course. There was people that came to Germany, concurrent travel, brought their family with them, had their household goods en route, mm-hmm. arrived in Germany, and were handed orders to Vietnam. They had to leave. Here was their family without any, all their household goods had to be shipped back. It was really a hardship on some people. Mm-hmm. It was not on my family.
You got to go back to the States.
Went back to the States, Fort Benning, and transitioned then into mm-hmm. Getting my family settled. Mm-hmm. I actually settled them in Burke Burnett, and then away I went.
Okay, so you got them back to Burke Burnett.
Yes.
And tell me about your family. How did Gail feel about you going to Vietnam?
That's interesting. She knew, we both knew that that was going, mm-hmm. that was coming. Mm-hmm. But have you ever heard of the officer's preference statement?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, the preference statement is when you're first reassigned
right.
to Germany, you fill out a preference statement.
Right.
For a CONUS, Continental United States mm-hmm. assignment, I would rather go first choice, second choice,
right.
third choice.
Yes.
For a short tour assignment, which basically was Korea at that time. There were some other short-term areas, but I don't remember them. But basically Korea, and then, of course, Vietnam was coming up. Well, when I got to Fort Benning to the career course, I filled out the perfect state. Here's where I want to go in CONUS for the short-term area. I've never lost anything in Korea. Vietnam's a place to go. So Vietnam's my first choice for a short-term area.
Okay.
Well, when my orders came down, it stated on the orders, you know, you're going to Vietnam, officer is Vietnam volunteer. When my wife read that, she went right into orbit. What do you mean, you volunteer? Wait a minute. And that's the way I volunteered. The political aspect of Vietnam, if they can say, look how many volunteers we've got going, that looks a lot better than we're having to just assign them there.
Right.
Right. So I volunteered for Vietnam.
So she was not very happy about that, or she
about the volunteer.
Was she okay with you going over to Vietnam?
Yeah. Oh, we sat down and we talked about it, and we said, hey, you know, that's where it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there's I don't know what the percentage is, but I might not come back except in a box.
Okay.
You know, that's the life we chose.
Right.
And my government said it's time, you know, it's your turn.
Mm-hmm.
You go.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a kind of a toss of the coin as to whether I went into the military assistance command, the advisory capacity, or to a U.S. unit, because the U.S. buildup was in 65, 66, and then because I was selected to go into the advisory channel, I had a couple other schools that I had to go to before I went. That's the reason I didn't go. My career course ended in, I think, May of 66.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to what they call the MATA course, Military Advisor something, at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. There were 6 weeks there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went for 8 weeks to Fort Bliss, Texas, for Vietnamese language training.
Okay.
And then, you know, because of this training, it was November before I actually got in country, 67.
Okay. Let me ask you about the your career course at Fort Benning.
Okay.
What was that like?
Sitting through some long, boring classes.
What were they teaching you in the classrooms?
Oh, you got everything from weapons to tactics to nuclear, biological, chemical warfare. Some of it was some of that aspect was actually classified secret.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you couldn't take any notes; you had to listen. It was really kind of boring.
Did you think it did you any good?
We had some field training exercises that. A three-day exercise. We'd go out and we'd play the games. This guy was the battalion commander, and for this one particular exercise, I was the XO. And these guys are your staff officers. Of course, we didn't have any troops out.
Mm-hmm.
We would play map exercises. You know, mm-hmm. The battalion commander would do his thing, and we would decide how we're going to attack and defend and
mm-hmm.
whatever we were going to do.
Mm-hmm. How were you at that? Did you feel comfortable doing that? That sort of war game?
Yeah, that was.
That's
what it's all about.
Were they teaching you ambushes or just how to?
No, mostly attack and defeat.
Okay.
Ambushes are on a much smaller level.
Right.
You very seldom. I was never taught an ambush. Now, let me retract that. Yes, in classroom. We never did any ambushing in our field training exercises.
Okay. Okay. When you went to Fort Bragg, what did they teach you there?
How to be an advisor. That's what they tried to teach you.
They tried to teach you.
Yeah.
Why do you say that? Tried.
Well, they would teach one thing. Let me cogitate on that just a minute.
Okay.
Say how I want to put that.
Sure.
There's utopia. Mm-hmm. Okay? This is the way we'd like it to be. And then there's the actuality on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, personalities enter in.
Right.
Your counterpart, the guy that you're supposed to be advising, how competent is he? And the more competent he is, the less advising you can do. About the only thing you can do, and I ran into this when I finally did get down to one-on district.
Mm-hmm.
About all I could do with that first district chief that I had contact with was kind of coordinate the American effort. We had a 01 bird dog mm-hmm. observation airplane at Province Headquarters. And when we were doing some of our little operations, we could get that observation airplane up. I could get maybe some supplies or equipment that the Vietnamese had a hard time getting. And you would run into, in a lot of cases, the Vietnamese would say, okay, you do it. No, that's not what we're here for. We're here to assist. You do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, I'm jumping ahead because I'm getting into the time that I was in Vietnam. I cannot remember the general officer's name, but he was a one-star general at corps level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you remember how the I Corps, First Corps, Second Corps, Third Corps, Fourth Corps was in the Delta. Mm-hmm. He was at corps level, and he came down to visit, and I almost fell out of my chair. I couldn't believe I was hearing this from that high level. We can't trust these people to do these things. We've got to get in there and do it for them.
He was saying this about his Vietnamese soldiers?
Or? He was saying it about... Now, he was an American.
Oh, this is an American?
This was an American general.
Okay.
Talking to low-level advisors.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to get in. And see, this was in direct contravention to everything that we had been trained to do. Mm-hmm. You don't do it for them. You get them to do it. You assist them in doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, we can't trust these guys to do that. You get in there and do it for them. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
And you were taught the opposite of Fort Bragg.
That's right. That's why I say there's the utopia up here, and then there's various levels below that, depending upon the personality of the leaders, mm-hmm. of the Vietnamese, and, of course, in this case, the American mm-hmm. leader. A brigadier general saying exactly the opposite of what the advisory courses are teaching in mm-hmm. the States.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that you really took your advising role very seriously and literally that I'm advising. I'm not doing.
Absolutely. That's what I was sent over there to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was sent over there to be the district senior advisor.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's where I was assigned. Whatever advisory position I got. But it wound up being the district senior advisor mm-hmm. in Wadong District, Gokong Province. And when I say I couldn't do much advising when I got there, the district chief that was there had been there for 8 or 10 years. And he knew everything about this district.
This is Vietnamese.
Vietnamese, yes. Mm-hmm. He was a Vietnamese major. Nguyen Van Thien.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ever learn how to say that NG?
Nguyen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a tough. There's no comparable American sound.
That's right.
Anyway, he had been there, and he knew where the Vietnamese families lived. The good guys.
Mm-hmm.
He knew where the VC families lived. He knew them.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the ins and outs of everything about that district. He had been there that long. Very competent. Very competent. And all I could do was just try to coordinate the American effort.
Mm-hmm. This was your counterpart.
Yeah, this was my counterpart.
Okay. Before we get there and do that, let me ask you a couple questions about before you went over to Vietnam. We talked about Fort Bragg. What about Fort Bliss?
Vietnamese language training.
Okay, language training. How were you with Vietnamese? Was it hard for you to pick up?
Yes.
Okay.
I picked up enough that I could get along.
Okay.
With my broken Vietnamese and their broken English, we could communicate. One of these very close friends, a Vietnamese sergeant, Sean, S-A-N-G, he didn't speak much English, but he spent a lot of time in our house. He loved to come over and play dominoes with us.
Mm-hmm.
But I could, you know, we could communicate. I'm sorry to say that I didn't learn more Vietnamese. I'm just slowly picking up a foreign language. I had Spanish in college, and it was very difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew enough that we could communicate.
Now, it didn't really impede your job in Vietnam, is what you're saying?
Pardon me?
It didn't really impede with your job in Vietnam.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They could speak good enough English, you could speak good enough Vietnamese, so you could communicate.
Yes. Okay. Now, the final district chief that I worked with did not speak much English. He spoke fluent French.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't speak French.
Right. Okay, so how did you get to the advising track? You said there was two tracks, basically assigned to an American company and infantry company, whatever, and then going to the advisor. How did you go to the advisory side?
Because in that great headquarters in the sky,
in Washington D.C.
I guess when they threw the dart, it hit advisor. You know, that's all I.
You were just assigned that.
Yeah.
You weren't ever told why.
No.
Okay.
Yours is not the reason why. Yours is but do or die.
Right.
You know, I got that. That was what my order said. Actually, I'm glad.
Mm-hmm.
I could have never had the experiences if I hadn't been there, but I, you know, it would have been a whole different ball game being assigned to a combat unit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had advisors down to battalion level. This is the regular South Vietnamese Army.
Mm-hmm.
And why I went into the district level, I don't know. That's what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
In my heart. But I never did have anyone ask me, Captain Wright, Major Wright, do you want to here or there? You're going here.
Oh, okay.
And when I got to GOCOM, before I was ever assigned there, I could have been maintained right there at sector headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the what sector, how it corresponds to province?
Yes, I do, but why don't you go ahead and say it for the record so people listening to this would know.
Sector level is the same as province.
Mm-hmm.
If you call it a sector operation, that's dealing with a military operation. If you say it's a province function, then it's you might say a civilian function. So I was not only the district senior advisor in Wadong District, but I was the subsector advisor on the military side.
Okay, so you handled everything.
Yes.
Okay. Did you like that?
Yes, very much so. Most of my subsector duties, when we'd run a sector operation, sector would put together two or three companies. They called them regional force companies, and they would take a Vietnamese officer off the staff at sector level and make him the battalion commander for this particular operation. And if it was in my district, then I would go out as his advisor.
Okay.
And we had functioned, you know, operation throughout the district. Very seldom did I ever go on a military operation with my district chief. And we had, more often than not, it was a single day operation. We'd start in the morning and come back in the evening.
Okay.
Occasionally, we got caught up in one night. I like that two times. I got eaten up by mosquitoes because I didn't go out prepared to spend the night.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right. But anyway, you know, because of the operation and the way things were going, we were required to spend the night.
Okay. Leaving Fort Bliss, did you have some time home with Gail?
And
did you have one child at this point or more?
Oh, I had three at least.
Three, okay, okay. Yeah. So you were able to spend some time with the family before you went over?
Yes.
How long did they give you?
I think I had about 30 days from the time I finished Fort Bliss until I actually had to handle it.
Okay. How'd you spend that time?
Getting settled in the house in Burke, being getting bank accounts squared away, getting military pay squared away, so she was getting sufficient money to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Being with the family.
Okay. So how did you feel when the day came when you had to leave?
Well, it's time to go. This is what I've been, this is what I've trained for 6-8 years. I said I was 67, seven years. It's time to go.
Very duty oriented.
Yeah. You know, I had no problem. I don't think Gail had any problem.
She understood as well.
Yeah. I flew out of Dallas to the San Francisco area.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove to Dallas, spent the night in a hotel. And next morning I got up and got on the airplane. And I flew out and she drove back on. And we began to write letters.
How was that flight out of San Francisco? Was this a civilian or military flight?
Well, it was what they call a Flying Tiger landing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a, I believe it was 707, but it had been stretched, and we were, there was about 200 of us on there. And it was tough. Little bitty seats.
Mm-hmm.
There was about, I think, 5 to the side, 10 across. And of course, you had your civilian stewardess, flight attendants, they call them.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like about the time you managed to get a little sleep, it was time to eat again.
Okay.
We flew from San Francisco out of an Air Force base there, I can't remember the name of it, to Alaska. Anchorage.
Okay.
Anchorage, refuel, got off the airplane for a few minutes, then we flew to Hawaii, and then we flew into Long Bend base, I believe. And then we started we flew in Saigon.
Okay.
And then they bused us downtown to what they called it Copler Compound.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we did all of our in-processing.
Okay. Before we get there, what was the mood on that airplane flying over?
Near festive.
Really?
Yeah, there wasn't any, oh, I'm about to die, I'm going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
I never did see that.
Hmm.
Never did.
Okay. About when you got into Tansanu, what did you think about Vietnam, your first impressions when you got off the airplane?
Good grief. Look at the level of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the shanties, you know, in downtown Saigon. Copra Compound was right downtown Saigon.
Okay.
And it was a cultural shock. I had never seen anything like that before.
What was your rank? Were you a major?
I was captain when I got there, and we were during the in processing. You had to fill out all kinds of paperwork. During the course of filling out that paperwork, the warrant officer came in and said, "Captain Wright, you have what you want. Don't fill out anything else as captain. You're a major."
To get promoted right when you arrived.
I had been promoted 2 or 3 days before, but it finally caught up.
Okay.
So I went to. Put on my gold leaf, and I was a big, tough, field-grade officer.
Besides noticing the impoverishment of the country, what else did you notice about Vietnam, Vietnamese civilians, the country itself, when you first arrived?
The traffic flow, the people, there were just people everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had a vehicle, you drove with your horn blasting all the time. trying to get people out of your way. Mm-hmm. The rickshaws, the bicycles, the little Cushman buses with people hanging all over them.
Mm-hmm.
Can't pick up the word. The confusion. Mm-hmm. It just seemed to be mass confusion. Okay. I guess they knew where they were going, but I didn't.
Now, what did you know about what America was doing in Vietnam when you arrived? What were you told? What was the goal for America?
Our goal was to, as I understood it, mm-hmm. was to make these people self-sufficient.
Okay.
So that they could do for themselves and maintain a democracy in their own country versus the communists of the North.
Okay.
And we wanted to get them to the point to where they could do that. Mm-hmm. And that's where we failed miserably.
Did you believe that could be done? Did you believe in that goal?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I certainly did.
Did that continue throughout your tour there? Your first tour?
Yes.
Okay. Did you find that the other men with you, the other Americans, also understood what America was doing in Vietnam and why they were there?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
That's not something that we really sat down and discussed.
Right.
But I never ran into anyone that didn't think they ought to be there.
So how much time did you spend there in Saigon before you went to your district?
I don't remember. It's like 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm. And what was involved in those 3 or 4 days?
Mostly in processing and being issued equipment. Mm-hmm. You got issued your weapon there. Mm-hmm. And the M14 rifle mm-hmm. was the rifle that the American units were using at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And those advisors that are not advisors, those people that were going to American units, they got the M14 rifle. We got the M2 carbine.
Okay.
And then the in processing, it just seemed like that. It just went on forever.
Mm-hmm.
Paperwork that you had to fill out and getting allotments and things for your family.
Mm-hmm.
And, at one point, I listened to, I actually saw it on TV, part of I believe their Super Bowl game.
Oh, really?
No, it wasn't, because this was in November. Well, anyway, it was an NFL game.
Football game.
They'd been played two or three days before.
Okay.
Had it on TV. I just watched it a minute.
Okay. Why don't we take a break with this one?
All right.
Okay, Jack, let's continue. Just wanted to mention, we have your map here in front of us. This is your original map that you had with you in Vietnam?
Yes, I had a copy. This is a map that I sent to my wife through the mail.
Okay.
So that when I said, you know, we're here, she could kind of follow along. She
okay.
wanted to know everything about what I was doing, what was going on in my life in Vietnam. So I sent her this map.
Great. So when you wrote her and you said I spent X amount of days here and there.
Yeah.
She knew. She could look on there and tell exactly where you were.
Yeah, and in some cases, I attached overlays to the letter so that she could put the overlay on there and see exactly where the military operation went that I was
wow.
telling her about.
So the Army censors had no problem with this? Or did they know about it?
I stand on the field.
Well, that's great that you got the information to her, so she could really follow what you've done.
I was never told specifically I couldn't do that. I never asked.
Okay.
Because once the operation was completed,
mm-hmm.
it was no longer it was never classified in the first place.
Okay.
And and once that operation, I wish I could come up with one of those overlays.
We also have your letters from your first tour and your second tour
yeah.
with us here.
This is the first tour.
Okay. How often did you write?
I wrote virtually every day. I didn't mail a letter every day. You see, here's the primary road to Gokong. This road was never traveled,
mm-hmm.
but this road was not open every day.
We couldn't get to Gold Con just any time we wanted to.
Because of the weather?
Because of the Viet Cong.
Okay.
And if this road wasn't open, we couldn't get to Gold Con. Now, we could get to Gold Con 3 to 5 times a week.
How far is that? How long is that distance?
About 15 miles.
Okay.
And that's,
dirt road, I'm assuming.
Well, it was somewhat paved, mostly dirt. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, about 12 kilometers, which is about 10 miles.
Okay, okay. So whenever you could go from, what's the name of the small town here? Vinh Binh?
Vinh Binh,
okay,
yes.
Once you could go from there to Gold Con, that's where you could mail your letters.
Yeah, we'd, okay. We'd mail, pick up. And this was our main supply base. We could pick up food. Mm-hmm. They had a commissary there. We'd have to buy the food and prepare it here. Mm-hmm. But if that road, well, there was a few occasions when we did travel that road when there hadn't been a road clearing operation. Now, a road clearing operation, we sent troops down that road from various locations to be sure there wasn't any mines in the road, mm-hmm. there wasn't any ambushes along the road. Mm-hmm. That's a road clearing.
And these are Arvin forces you're sending out?
Let me take a minute and explain mm-hmm. the level of the troops in Vietnam.
Okay.
Your lowest level troops are your popular force PF troops. Mm-hmm. They receive about 6 weeks of training, issued a weapon, and sent back to their home where they live.
These villages, small villages.
Village out in the middle of nowhere, anyway, wherever they live. And the idea was that these people would do their rice farming during the day and then man outpost or whatever during the night.
How often did that happen? Did they actually man an outpost with a weapon?
Frequently.
Okay.
But yeah, there was a lot of outposts. We had a lot of outposts along. When they were in the outpost, they lived there. Their family was in there with them. Mm-hmm. And these are, you know, mud burns and they lived there. But these were your popular forces. Their pay was somewhat equivalent to less than $30 a month.
Okay.
At your next level, then, was your regional forces, mm-hmm. RF.
Okay.
Now, your popular forces were organized no higher than platoon level, about 35 men. Your regional forces they received more training, a little higher caliber, higher class weapon, mm-hmm. and were organized in companies.
Okay.
There was about 100 men in a regional force company.
Okay.
And they were usually located within their home province or home district. Mm-hmm. For example, we had, I don't remember how many PF platoons we had scattered throughout Wadong District, but we had one regional force company.
Okay.
And they were co-located with the district headquarters. They had their own compound just adjacent to the district compound.
Okay.
And this was our regional force company.
Okay. Now, what weapons did the PF forces have? What were they issued?
M1 carbines.
Okay. And then how about the RF forces?
Basically the same thing.
Okay.
They had some of the M1 rifles and some of the VC weapons that we took away, but primarily were the old M1 rifles.
Okay, and how much contact did you have with the PF forces? Did you go visit them and make sure everything was okay?
That was one of our biggest things that we did was to go move throughout where we could throughout the district to visit our troops, to show our support to our troops that were out here mm-hmm. in these lonely mud huts.
Mm-hmm. And when you say go visit the troops, was it just you and your South Vietnamese forces with you, or was there more than you, just one American?
No, I very seldom ever went out alone.
Okay.
I would go out with my district chief. When he would go out, I knew it was safe to go with him. And so I accompanied him whenever we'd go throughout the district to visit, to make his presence known. And like I said, this first district chief, all I did was follow around like a little puppy dog.
This is an American, or this is a Vietnamese?
No, this is Vietnamese.
This is the Vietnamese. Okay.
District chief is Vietnamese.
Right. Okay. So you were the only American out on some of these.
Well, I had part of my team with me. I had about I think I was authorized about seven man team. But when I got there was an assistant, a medic, and a radio operator. Mm-hmm. And then later on, we got an operations sergeant, and then the district senior advisor, me.
Okay.
So there was four or five of us there all the time.
Okay. All right. Just wanted to get kind of clear of exactly what this.
And there would be two or three of us would go accompany the, you know, we'd jump in our Jeep and go with the district chief.
Okay.
And the district chief, depending upon where we were going, he had always had his bodyguards with him. He had 10 specially selected, hand-picked bodyguards that the district chief would get in his Jeep, and they were hanging all over that Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
All 10 of them got on that Jeep somewhere and went with the district chief.
Okay. How many Vietnamese or Arvin troops would go out with you on average?
Well, like I say, depending on where you're going. If we're going close, there'd be just the 10 bodyguards. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'd take one or two platoons, 30 to 60 men with us. They'd jump on an old truck, and here we go. Depending upon where we were going, how far we were going, how long we planned to be out.
Okay.
We left to go up here to this village on this river, Dong Toi, mm-hmm. in Dong Son Village.
Mm-hmm.
That was through contested territory.
Okay.
We had Vietnamese-controlled territory, VC-controlled territory, mm-hmm. and contested territory.
Okay.
And when the contested territory was the territory that the Vietnamese owned in the daytime and the Viet Cong owned at night.
Okay. Before we get in more detail on that, continue. Popular forces, regional forces, and then is that it?
Okay.
That you had to deal with?
No. Then your next level is your Army of Vietnam, ARVN, right. forces. Mm-hmm. And they received basically the same type of training that American troops receive, basic training, advanced individual training. At least that was the goal.
Right.
Now, I was never with those people, so I don't know how much training they actually did receive.
Okay.
They had the high level equipment, the best equipment. They had radios, mm-hmm. Communications equipment. We saw very few of those.
Very few of the ARVN.
Yes.
Okay.
In this area, we at some point. Mid-1968, we had elements of the U.S. 9th Infantry Division come in to Gokong Province to conduct some operations.
Sure. All right, so why don't you go ahead and say what exactly your job was, as it was explained to you, and then what it was in reality for you, what you had to do on a daily basis.
As I recall, basically the school program was that you are there to primarily advise and assist your Vietnamese counterpart in his daily operation.
Okay.
As a subsector command or advisor, this was the military. How you advance, how you move, how you deploy your troops. As a district senior advisor, was to assist in the pacification, and that's a good term, of the countryside, the civilian operations.
Mm-hmm.
We were I'll say, somewhat instrumental in getting supplies and needing material, needed material for schools, primarily schools, mm-hmm. bridges, mm-hmm. Road repair.
Okay.
That was kind of the big. No, that's not the word I want. That's the way we were taught.
Okay.
When you got down there, you just had to move very slowly, because especially with this first district chief, mm-hmm. he had been there a long time. He had had a lot of American advisors, and if you crossed him, he'd get rid of it. All he had to do was go to his next higher headquarters in the Vietnamese chain, and they would go right to the province level advisor, and they'd jerk you out of there. I never did see this, mm-hmm. but I know that happened. So I moved very carefully and worked. Tried to work with him. It takes a long time to win the confidence of the Vietnamese, okay. especially those that have been there a long time, like Major Tien had. Mm-hmm. And so I had to move very carefully and kind of tiptoe around it, and it was. I didn't really win his confidence until just a few weeks before he was medevaced out and never came back. He was wounded,
really,
and was medevaced out, and he never came back. And I was just beginning to get some rapport with mm-hmm. him. Mm-hmm.
Why did you say it's hard to gain their trust?
I don't know why they had a distrust of Americans.
Okay. Was it just Americans or Westerners or?
And just Americans. I didn't see any other. There were some other Westerners at province level, but I had very little contact with them.
Okay.
I really think they had the impression that we were wanting to take over and run their country for them. Mm-hmm. And this is what was tearing some of us advisors up, because we were taught that, no, we're not trying to take over. And yet here's this general officer saying, you take over. See, I didn't want to run his, I didn't want to be the boss of his district or his mm-hmm. subsector. Mm-hmm. I wanted to assist him. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, not in Major Ken's case, but in the specifically in the man that was the temporary district chief between Major Ken and Major Sean. You do it for me. Mm-hmm. I have no order. I can't do it. You do it.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, that was a rough period. But again, it's that utopia, and then what's actually on the ground, and it's personalities. I had a very strong district chief, Wallach, for example, over in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Had a weak district chief, and the American advisor there, he ran that district a lot. Mm-hmm. This district chief over here was a first lieutenant. My district chief was a major,
mm-hmm.
and he was young and inexperienced. And that advisor, because of his strong personality, he did a lot of things over here that I could never do here.
Mm-hmm. Did it cause bad problems between the two? Did you ever have to coordinate your forces with his forces?
No, never did. The coordination was normally done at province level.
Mm-hmm.
When they were going to run a province exercise
mm-hmm.
in my district,
mm-hmm.
they had pulled together a regional force company from here and a regional force company from here, and then my regional force company, and maybe two or three. Maybe they'd get three PF platoons and then pick somebody to be a PF company commander, a Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd have three or four companies in an operation in Wadong District. Well, that's when I became the advisor to the subsector operation. Mm-hmm.
You would help coordinate their movements and what they needed to do.
Yeah, as best I could. This was all done at Providence headquarters, and we'd get the copies of the overlays there, and I keep thinking I'm going to run into one of those. Mm-hmm. And you know, we just went along with them. Got your mortars, ammunition, communications. Yeah, everything's ready. Here we go. And many of these operations, especially early on, were just a walk in the hot sun.
Okay.
We'd go in here and come back out.
And what exactly would you do when you say you went in there?
Well, we were, I guess they were similar to what they call search and destroy operations.
Okay.
We were going in hoping to flush out VC,
okay,
the guerrillas,
mm-hmm,
and kill or capture. You know, it's just that simple. Kill or capture. In Wadong District, we had better luck with ambushes than we did with high-level operations.
Stuff that you set up? Ambushes that you set up personally? Or you guys did it at your level?
At my level.
Okay.
My district chief set them up.
Okay.
He trained his own people. He would bring in his civilian cadre, district chief, hamlet chief, and give them military-type training. And they were just civilians.
Mm-hmm.
These were elected positions.
Mm-hmm.
And he would try to give them military-type training. And then he would put his people out in ambush positions, and we had a lot of success. And when I say a lot of success, maybe during the time I was there, our ambushes killed or captured 15 or 20 VC.
Okay.
Well, that was a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the type of enemy we were fighting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So your success was based on the body count?
Yes.
Okay.
body count, there was one night one of our ambushes scored. And they brought in a civilian-type hat that had a human brain in it. Well, okay, you get a kill for that.
Okay. Did you keep a chart of how many killed, how many wounded enemy?
I didn't. The district chief did.
Okay.
And then whenever we'd have to brief someone, you know, we had the charts with, mm-hmm, with the figures on how many, from going back about 6 or 8 years. Bad guy losses versus good guy losses.
Okay.
VC versus friendly troops.
Did the district chief or anybody that you know of ever inflate those numbers to make it look like you're having more success?
Not during my tour there.
Did you hear about that happening?
Yeah, I heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was more up in the northern areas than down here. I've said this before. This is one of the most pacified areas in country at that time. We had our province senior advisor was,
mm-hmm,
a civilian,
mm-hmm,
and his assistant was the military man. Now you get up into the less pacified region, your province senior advisor is the military man,
mm-hmm,
and his assistant is a civilian.
Right.
So we had a civilian sitting here, and then of course his assistant, the deputy province advisor, was my boss,
mm-hmm,
but he was my boss's boss,
mm-hmm,
and I had some good rapport, if you will, with the province senior advisor. I had better communications with the civilian than I did with the with my boss.
Hmm. Okay. How did the other Americans that were with you there, how did they get along with the Vietnamese forces?
Like me, very well. With the people that we lived with, that we had contact with, we loved them and they loved us.
So you had good rapport with these people, and I guess that really aided your operations.
Yes. I had, all for the first several months, I had better rapport with the people than, mm-hmm, I did with the district chief. He was rather aloof.
Mm-hmm. Major Tim.
Major Tim.
Mm-hmm.
And because he had been there so long, and he was of the opinion that he wasn't going to be there much longer, that he was going to be transferred. He didn't know where. I think the province would have been in good hands if they had promoted him and made him the province chief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they didn't do that because he was wounded and shipped out, and I lost track of him. I don't know where he went from there.
Okay. How was he wounded?
That's kind of interesting, too. The only real mortar attack that we came under in Vien Minh City, the mortars were set up somewhere here in what we call the Coconut Grove, and as you can see, this is VC controlled territory.
Okay, let me just say you're pointing a little bit southwest.
South.
Vien Minh City.
Yeah. And they set up their mortar. There was, and we saw this from the air. I flew over the area after it happened. There was a rice paddy dye that was it pointed right straight at the district headquarters, just as straight as you could point your finger. And they set their mortar up there, and it was either 5 or 7 rounds that they got in the air before the first one ever landed. You know, a mortar is a high angle fire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, boy, they pumped those rounds in there, and then they grabbed their mortar and run. And those rounds didn't get inside the district compound,
mm-hmm.
but one of them hit just outside the wall, a cement block wall that was around the district compound. And the district chief's house sat here, and his headquarters, district headquarters, is here, and there was a tin roof breezeway,
mm-hmm.
so that the district chief could come out of his house and get into his office or into his tactical operations center without getting wet during the rainy season.
Okay.
Somehow, a little piece of shrapnel got up in under that tin roof, and we could see the mark where it ricocheted down and caught the district chief right in here as he was going from his house to his tactical operations center.
Okay, his upper chest.
Upper chest,
yes. Right side.
And he went down. And I was notified real quick. I grabbed my medic, and there were still explosions going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we rushed over there. My medic ripped his clothes off, or, you know, the shirt off where he could see what it was, and treated it as a sucking chest wound, although it wasn't.
Okay.
It never did get into the lung. But that's, you know, we had to treat it that way. I went, as soon as I saw what was happening, having my medic, you know, give him the immediate first aid, I went back and got on my radio. And I called province headquarters and I said, I need a medevac. My chief is down. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can't, you know, we haven't got, and about that time, someone cut in. The someone was a Navy armed helicopter. We called them Sea Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And they operated up and down these rivers frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And that pilot cut province off, said, this is Sea Wolf, whatever his call sign was. Mm-hmm. I've got to get some people off here. I'll be there in 15 minutes. Be prepared to pop smoke. Man, we grabbed that chief. And went out to the north edge of the village, the town here, to an open area. And here comes Sea Wolf, and I mean, we popped in. You never did tell. You don't tell what color smoke you're gonna pop.
Right.
We popped smoke grenade, and he said, "I see green smoke or whatever it was. That's us. Come on in." And within 15 minutes, we had that wounded district chief on his way to a U.S. hospital in Meta. And they took care of it. It wasn't nearly as serious as it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know, and we
right.
treated it as very serious. And my stock went up several levels in the Vietnamese eyes in this town because I took care of their district chief.
Right.
But the Vietnamese are their... when they lose a leader, they don't know what to do. They don't have the... what am I trying to say? The initiative
mm-hmm.
that American troops do.
Mm-hmm.
If the sergeant goes down, someone will step up and take his place.
Mm-hmm.
If the lieutenant goes down, right, you know, they
mm-hmm.
they won't do that. By the time I got back to the district compound after getting the chief medevaced out. Here were soldiers wandering around with, what do I do now? They're coming out of the fighting positions, the defensive positions around that district headquarters, because our chief's gone. What are we going to do now? Mm-hmm. And this is where that communication came in. I grabbed that Vietnamese sergeant, literally, grabbed his collar, and I said, Sergeant Shun, if you don't get those people back in those fighting positions, I'll get a stick and I'll get them back in there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he turned around and went shouting. And literally, I saw people went in head first. Uh-huh. They dove back into those fighting positions, but someone had to take command.
Right.
And I told my boss the next day, I said, I got a little command time yesterday. But when the leader goes down, they don't know what to do.
Right. Did you find that pretty consistent throughout your tour?
Yes. Yes, I did.
These are regional forces?
Pardon me?
Were these regional forces there?
No, these were popular forces.
Those are popular forces.
Yeah.
In guarding
when that mortar when that mortar attack started, we had a 60-millimeter mortar, mm-hmm. an 81-millimeter mortar, and, of course, all kinds of small arms, machine guns and rifles and what have you. And when those rounds landed, we answered. I don't know. I can't remember how many, several hundred mortar rounds, 60 and 81, literally several hundred. One of our outposts on the southeastern edge of the city, mm-hmm. we had to resupply them with small arms ammunition.
Because
they had expended so much and they never had seen anybody. They knew about where it came from, and oh my gosh, at the shooting that was going on.
Why don't you tell me what your typical mission was like when you would go out on an operation? And first of all, would you do them mostly during the day?
Yes.
Okay. And how long typically would they last? Would you leave, say, in the morning and come back before sundown, or what?
Most of the time, that's the way it was. We would go out on, and I'll call it a search and destroy, and it was more search and destroy because we had very little contact.
Okay.
Gather our forces together at a predetermined location, and we would start moving, and we would go to various objectives, mm-hmm. and we'd go through, and very few times did we ever have any major contact.
Okay.
We never did have any major contact.
What was the average contact that you would have?
One or two. You mean the average number of contacts?
Yes. Well, what was it? Well, that too, but the average, what was it like? Average, you know, one or two shots fired? Okay, and that was it.
Yeah, one or two shots fired. And there was exceptions to that. Mm-hmm. The first time that we went out and had to stay overnight, mm-hmm. I've probably got that overlay there somewhere, but we went in and it was... got along a river line somewhere, and a VC was a boatload of them trying to get across that river. And all of the shooting, and those guys weren't very good, our guys, mm-hmm. weren't very good shots, mm-hmm. because they weren't but 150 yards or so out and they couldn't hit them. And they were shooting with BARs, rifles, machine guns. And they still got across the river.
My gosh. Now, did you fire, or any of your Americans fire?
No.
Why not?
Why? They're doing, you know, they're shooting enough.
Okay, because you figured they would probably hit something.
Even though I had a rifle, uh-huh. an M2 carbine, uh-huh. most of the time I'd leave it back at the compound. Mm-hmm. Someone had come up with a 38 revolver, 38 caliber revolver. And I felt like, you know, I was John Wayne. I had a six gun on my hip.
Mm-hmm. So that's what you would go in the field with most of the time.
Yeah, so I would carry that. After we captured that M16 rifle, I carried it, had it out that time when they shot it. Mm-hmm. Carry a pistol. Mm-hmm. I wasn't out there to fight. Mm-hmm. I was out there to advise. And I, you know, I would try to move the people around when they were shooting. Move up a little closer. Mm-hmm. It got frustrating.
Really?
Sometimes. But that was one of the major contacts that we had, and we've probably killed five or six Vietnamese on that operation. We got hung up and had to stay out overnight. We were going through mud. I got in mud literally up to here.
Wow.
And sunk down.
And you're pointing to just below your waist.
Yeah, just below my waist. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get my legs up. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to get out, and a Vietnamese came up, and I reached out, and he pulled and broke me over, and I like to drown before I could, you know, get back up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that we were in. Mm-hmm. On this particular operation, we had to cross a smaller river,
mm-hmm.
and actually my operation sergeant, an E6, was carrying the radio. I don't know where my RTO was. I run one RTO off, and maybe I hadn't got a replacement yet. But he was carrying the radio, and we went across this little old stream. I say little old stream. He went completely under. Of course, it wiped out the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no contact with province headquarters. Vietnamese did.
Right. How many missions did you actually, or operations did you actually conduct during a tour there? Do you remember? Or a ballpark? Was it like 200 or 300 or 25?
Closer to 25.
Okay.
That I actually participated in.
Okay. Were you able to call in American assets, air power, if you needed it?
Not during any of the operations. We'd have that observation aircraft up, mm-hmm. and we coordinate, contact him and get him to check out, you know, we got something off over here, vicinity coordinates, such and such. Mm-hmm. And of course, he could, he had his map, and he'd go check out things for us. And we liked to lost an American radio operator on one of the operations through exhaustion. And I can't tell you where it was, but it was in my district because I was out as the battalion advisor.
Mm-hmm.
He went down, and we lost contact with him. And I never will forgive those people that were out there with him, the Americans, and left him.
A wounded American?
He wasn't wounded. He was just exhausted.
Oh, okay.
In fact, he had passed out.
Okay.
And they stayed with their Vietnamese counterparts and left this RTO there. And I knew where they were coming out of the operational area, and I stayed there,
mm-hmm.
until after dark, until I saw that RTO come out, mm-hmm. and the Vietnamese brought him out. He was completely unconscious, and they had put a sling type affair on a stick of some kind, you know, mm-hmm. big enough to carry his weight, and they carried him out.
Hmm. Why did the Americans leave?
I can't answer that. I don't know. I know if I had been their boss, they'd have been missing some parts of their backside. But I just could not believe that they had gone off and left him. And when that kid come out, I saw that he was taken care of,
mm-hmm.
and then I went on home.
Mm-hmm. What would you go out in the field with? You said you had your 38 with you. What else would you carry?
Oh, I used to carry some sea rations.
Mm-hmm.
Wear a flak vest. Sometimes flak vest got too hot and heavy, so I'd leave it home.
Okay.
I never did wear a steel pot. I always wore a soft cap or something.
Okay.
That bush hat.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever worried about snipers? I mean, obviously you related that one incident where you were shot at, but...
No. That's part of the game, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You learn to live with danger. You're in a combat zone.
Mm-hmm.
It is dangerous. And if you dwell on those kind of things, you're going to lose your mind.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go crazy. For example, when we did get shot at down here,
mm-hmm.
and one of the sniper fired two shots. One of them passed overhead because I could hear the crack of the bullet as it was breaking the cell barrier.
Okay.
It's a very distinct crack. And the second one went and punctured the rear tire over on this side.
Okay.
And this Vietnamese sergeant friend of mine was sitting there with his feet over that tire. It went right between his legs.
Hmm.
Well, when it... when it happened, I went to shooting, and I turned to my assistant who was driving, and I said, "DD, DD." That's go, as you know, in Vietnamese. I was yelling DD, and he was yelling at me, "Keep shooting, keep shooting." Well, as we got on down the road at Short Peaks, there was an old French-built armored car behind us, mounted on rubber four wheels, mm-hmm. with a twin 30 caliber machine gun turret on the top. Well, he swung that turret over, and he went firing out in that vicinity. The driver was more interested in watching out here and ran off of the dike and turned over.
Gosh.
No one was. The only injury on that contact, we had some troops up further up the road here. Well, as that armored car went over and he was falling, he kept his hand on the trigger. He was holding on.
Oh, boy.
And wounded one of our troops. But when we got back to the district, to our house, mm-hmm. we'd sit around and laugh about it. You know, and ha ha ha. You don't sit around and say, "Oh my gosh, mm-hmm. did you see how close that was at the angle? I could see that second round coming. It was a tracer. I could see it. Mm-hmm. And if we had been moving forward, it would have caught me somewhere in this area. That's about the height it came."
You're talking about, you're pointing to your right waist.
Yeah.
Right side waist.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Somewhere in the hip area, or mm-hmm. maybe even up into the abdominal cavity area.
Okay.
But I didn't sit around and cry, and, "Oh, my Lord, look how close. I was hollering at you, D.D. Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. I'm telling you to keep shooting." you don't sit around and mope about it. That's what you're getting paid for.
Mm-hmm.
I trained for 7 years to get into something like this.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see if I had been trained well. I think I had.
Okay.
I felt confident in what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Did those your troopers, did they have confidence in you? Did this confidence go back and forth?
Yeah.
Okay.
We would sit down and discuss the pros and cons of what we were trying to do, and after TIP of 1968, I got my team together and we said, "Look, if we're going to be overrun, what are we going to do?"
Mm-hmm.
"Well, try to get into GOCOM." "How?" "We, you know, there's no way we could get, if we're being overrun, and if we're going to be overrun, it's going to come from a southerly direction."
Mm-hmm.
This is the actually, this was a VC, Viet Cong R&R area down here at this Coconut Grove.
Okay.
But this is where it's going to come. And the chances of us getting into GOCOM were two, slim and none.
Right.
So we said, "We'll stay here with our friends. We will fight alongside them. And if we get killed, so be it. This is where we're going." And we agreed. This is what we're going to do. We had a big bunker built onto our house, and we said, "Okay, the next guy, when you're next to rotate out to go home, mm-hmm. then you'll move out of the house into the bunker, and you can sleep in that bunker, because if a mortar round or a RPG rocket propelled grenade mm-hmm. hits our house, we're going to all be wounded, mm-hmm. at least, you know, if not killed." Because our house was just, it had a metal frame, but it had the bamboo coverings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get to move in there to sleep if you want to. None of us ever did. But they had, that was just, you know, we agreed upon that.
Mm-hmm.
I was the boss. They knew I was the boss. But we sat down and we talked. Mm-hmm. And I had a real good team.
What were your living quarters like?
Well, I've got some pictures of them, but like I say, it was a metal frame house, and about two-thirds of the way up was wood walls, and then screen, you know, it had to be open for ventilation, and then the bamboo roof. What on district What on Vin Vin City, my headquarters there was the R&R Center of Gokong Province. People loved to come down there. The town had a diesel-powered generator and supplied electricity to the town. Now, we paid about $30 a month for our electricity. But we had electricity. We had ceiling fans. We had oscillating fans. We had our refrigerator was one of the old kerosene-fired refrigerators. Hmm. You ever seen one of those?
No, I have not.
They're quite old. Mm-hmm. It was old, but the kerosene fire somehow through that system gave us freezers. Mm-hmm. We could make ice and keep our food cool. Mm-hmm. We had propane for our kitchen stove. Mm-hmm. Our Vietnamese houseboy was our cook. Oh, he was a good.
All the Americans lived together in this.
Yeah, place. Yeah, we had that one house. The as you went in, that was basically the office area until we got our bunker completed. Then we moved the office and radios out in the bunker, but that was our office area and our living room. We had a TV. Hmm. We got TV from Saigon. It'd come on about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and went till about 10 o'clock at night, and. We'd watch TV. We would kid. You remember the TV series Combat? Mm-hmm. We watched Combat. If you watch Combat so many nights, then you got to CIB. And 12 o'clock high. Uh-huh. They took 12 o'clock high off just before we got enough time to get to Aramet.
Okay, so what other programs? Did you see news programs?
They had news. It wind up every night with a news broadcast. Uh-huh. And weather report for the Vietnam area. Mm-hmm. and then the R&R areas, mm-hmm. Thailand, and then the final part of just before they'd go off there, they'd have flight. Remember that? Fly up amongst the clouds, touch the face of God, and then the national anthem. Hmm. That was it for the night.
Okay. So were you able to keep up with news back in the United States at all?
Yes, but I have very few memories of that because I didn't want to know what they were doing. Because the things they were doing were so contrary to everything I believed.
Some of the anti-war movement.
The anti-war, yes. I just... I didn't want to hear it. If I don't hear it, then it's not happening.
Okay.
And probably not a good philosophy, but I was busy. I had things to do. Mm-hmm. I believed in what I was doing. I believed in my government. I believed in following orders, not to the extent of the Nazis in World War II. I would never do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Vietnamese did.
What do you mean?
I saw some very harsh treatment of POWs during the course of, especially one of the operations. That particular operation where we caught the VC going across the river, we captured a VC.
Okay.
They put a rod between his, had his hands back here. He was down on his knees. They had a pistol to his head. They were trying to get some information out of him. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, one of the Vietnamese kicked him right in the face. Just kicked him. I got on the radio as quick as I could, and I said, "You better get someone down here to get this guy out." Talking to the Americans,
right?
Get this guy out here, or they're gonna kill him. Well, they did. That was one time
they killed him.
No, they got him out. That was one time that the province responded to me, and got there. The I believe he was. Well, his name was Ruth, R-U-T, Major Ruth, and he was a major. Got promoted to lieutenant colonel, and he became the deputy province advisor when the other. The other province advisor rotated out.
Mm-hmm.
he came in a helicopter and extracted that prisoner. Got him out of there.
Or he probably would have been killed.
I no doubt in my mind.
Okay. Anything else did you see that was like that?
yes, and it was rather disgusting. On one of the operations, mm-hmm. somewhere in this area of Wadong District.
We're pointing to the northeast.
To the northeast, yeah, the northeast sector. We'd been out all day, and we had had no contact since early morning. And people get tired and lax.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of our soldiers, there was one of the Vietnamese houses, you know, grass roof, mm-hmm. grass side, you know. They went up to the front door, and they caught a belly full of fire.
Okay, this is when right. the popular forces guys went up to the front door.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, they were careless. They just walked up to that door, and there was two VC in there. And they just shot through the door and cut them both down. We managed to get them out, and one of them died.
Mm-hmm.
The other was seriously wounded. Mm-hmm. And of course, we went to putting a heavy volume of fire into that house. Well, all of the Vietnamese houses... over in one corner of the house, inside, they had one of these thick-walled mud bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they never knew when someone was going to be shooting. And the family would go in there. Well, the two VC managed to get in there. And we found out later that one of them was severely wounded and died in there. But the other one would stay back in a corner there. And then when the firing would let up, mm-hmm. he'd run out and shoot through the wall. An automatic weapon, AK-47. And he wasn't shooting up there. Let me tell you, he wasn't shooting up there, because this another dumb stunt that a foolish American did. Actually, my intention was good. I was trying to find a way to get this guy, capture him.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally crawled on my belly up behind a little old rice paddy. Little old dike about this high,
mm-hmm.
and was looking, and he went to shoot, and I mean I went down as low as I could get, and dirt was literally coming over that dike and mm-hmm. hitting me on the head and the back,
mm-hmm.
and I decided that wasn't any place for me, and I got out of there. Well, we had no way to set that building on fire. We tried tracers, and it wouldn't do it. And a Arvin battalion, Vietnamese regular force battalion, mm-hmm. came onto the scene about that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they had one thermite grenade. A thermite grenade, you know, is a burning...
Mm-hmm.
So it was decided that had one soldier that would crawl up as close as he could get to the house while we're putting a heavy volume of fire into that house to keep the Vietnamese head down. And he gets up as close as he can crawl. We stop the fire. He runs up a few steps and throws that grenade all the way over the house.
Oh, no.
Well, as luck would have it, as it passed over the top of the house, a piece of the burning element fell out and set the house on fire. Now the house is it burns fast, that mm-hmm. dry bamboo,
mm-hmm.
and it's fully engulfed. And the VC, that the one live VC, comes running out. He's literally on fire. He's burning. I'm watching him.
Mm-hmm.
He is burning. He runs out. He gets through the wall because it's all burned away, and he takes about three or four steps out, and they open fire. Everything they've got,
mm-hmm.
and literally blast him back into the house.
Wow.
What?
I said, wow.
Wow, yeah. I guess that's the first human being, first and last human being I've ever watched killed.
Right.
And, I thought, oh, no. You know, what could we... He didn't have his weapon. He was on fire. He, you know, probably wounded. But all we got was a body.
How did you deal with death in that sense, and also overall when you would experience that?
In that sense was of course disgust, and then you have to go back and place it in context of the kind of people they were, the kind of life that they had. What was life to these people? I didn't see any American casualties. You know, any Americans killed, I heard about them. We had one or two killed in within the province while I was there. That's one of the hazards of the game. You have to know that as a military man in a combat zone, you might get killed. I'm sorry. You know, I felt for them. I felt for their families. But it's over. You know, it's done.
Okay. How did you deal with the stresses of combat like that in that sense and in general? And the stress of being in a combat zone. How did you deal with that?
Didn't think about it. I didn't feel any stress per se because of the combat zone.
Mm-hmm.
I guess most of my stress was the fact that I was separated from my family.
Right.
Yeah. And later on in the tour, there was some personal problems developed at home that was putting a lot of pressure on Gail, on my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And that created some stress problems on me, but it wasn't because of the combat situation. In my own mind, there wasn't any stress there. I lived with, accepted the fact that I could get killed or wounded any day, and I didn't. That didn't bother me. I didn't dwell on that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact of life. Just as sure as the sun comes up in the morning, mm-hmm. you know that could be my last day on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so be it. And honestly, that was my opinion. That's not 30 years later thinking about it. That's the way I felt then.
How would you rate the Viet Cong as an enemy?
There's several levels of the enemy there. You've got your guerrillas, you've got your Viet Cong, and then you've got your VC main force. And then, of course, your NVA, North Vietnamese Army.
Mm-hmm.
Your guerrillas, which was our primary enemy, were very low-level, untrained, no communications. Your main force VC were about equivalent or maybe a little more, a little higher trained than our regional force companies.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty good troops. I think they had the same problem that our Vietnamese troops had. Once they lose their leader, they're lost. Mm-hmm. This was a part of their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had any contact with the NVA, so I couldn't address them. From what I saw and have heard since, they were good troops.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What would you say were their main strengths, VC?
I guess able to survive in the harsh environment.
Okay.
Survive as long as they did. And when I talk about a harsh environment, there's no roads in this area.
Mm-hmm.
It's wet and cold during the rainy season, and dry and hot during the dry season. They had no electricity.
Mm-hmm.
They had plenty of rice.
Mm-hmm.
The low level Vietnamese farmers in this area, they didn't know politics.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know the government of Vietnam versus the Viet Cong. The VC would come in and say, "We want so much of your rice, we're taxing you." Okay. The government of Vietnam would come in and say, "We want so much of your rice, we're taxing you." Okay. Leave me alone. Now, this is the farmer. Leave me alone. Leave my children, my family alone. Don't take my son. Leave us alone, and we'll pay your taxes. This was kind of the peasant attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they lost a lot of their sons because they would take them. A lot of the guerrillas, a lot, I can't say that. I can say some. didn't know any more what they were doing than some of our popular force troops.
Mm-hmm.
Our popular force troops were told, you man that outpost, and anyone comes in shooting at you, you shoot back. That's about it. These guerrillas, that's about the same thing they do. When you see one of those guys, you shoot him.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense that the Vietnamese civilians and these popular forces and NVC just wanted the Americans to leave?
No.
They wanted that protection.
The number of American forces that were there when I was there was so insignificant that they didn't even, the peasants, the low-level peasants, didn't know we existed.
Mm-hmm.
Except when we had come out and visit in their area with the Vietnamese officials.
Right. Right. Okay.
Oh, I've got to tell this. The Vietnamese are a very humble people,
mm-hmm.
but they carry a great deal of respect for their leaders,
mm-hmm.
the district chief. Mm-hmm. The district chief would be driving down the road, and there's a school over here.
Mm-hmm.
School is out, and little children, first, second graders, would run out and line the road, and as the district chief would drive by, they would
bow.
They just a little bow.
Mm-hmm.
Little bow. And when the district chief would approach the civilians, you know, when he was out,
mm-hmm.
they would give him that courtesy.
Hmm.
Just amazed me.
Respect for elders, respect for authority.
Elders are respected, greatly respected.
Mm-hmm.
The senior member of the family,
mm-hmm.
is number one. They didn't call him number one, mm-hmm. but the eldest son in the family is called Hai. Hai, as you know, is number two in Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
He is number two. He's never number one as long as that father's alive. And Major Tim told me this, that many people called him Hai, mm-hmm. because he was number two. He was his father's eldest son.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
This was their way of life.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about their way of life? Was it something that you could respect, something that you could easily integrate yourself into while you were there, or was it something that was really foreign to you?
It was it was mostly foreign. I could respect it. I could integrate into it to a certain extent. We had been told that you do not eat uncooked food.
Right.
Don't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, towards the last part of my tour over there, I could not go into a civilian's home and be offered food and turn it down. I would not offend him.
Mm-hmm.
I went way out of my way to not offend these people. I appreciated their way of life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could ever integrate into it.
Right.
But that's their way of life, and I respected that and loved those people dearly. I came home with possibly a form of dysentery.
Really?
Yeah. It was several weeks after I got back before I really got myself straightened out.
Hmm.
Lost a lot of weight. Of course, I managed to find most of it. Eventually.
Did you ever run into any Pathet Lao or Khmer troops from Cambodia or Laos? Were they?
No. Now, we had a Cambodian in one of our outposts, and you will see him in the slides.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great big old one.
Really?
Yeah. The Vietnamese are about like this, and he's great. Uh-huh. He's right in front.
Uh-huh.
One of the outposts. He was, and I never. If I knew the story of how he got there, I've forgotten it. But they pointed him out to him. He's Cambodian.
Hmm. Okay.
And that's to the best of my knowledge and belief, that's the only Cambodian that I saw while I was there.
Did you ever run into any of the other Allied forces, any Australian, New Zealand troops, the Republican?
There was a Spanish medical team at province level, had some contact with them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the slides that I didn't bring, which I will get to, are of some of the other nations' leaders that were over there. I don't know whether they were sightseeing or what they were doing there,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know what the three pretty Vietnamese girls were doing with them. I've got an opinion, but I'll withhold that.
Okay.
My opinion is they were prostitutes that they were carrying.
That's something I wanted to ask you about. Were they prevalent? Was that available to your men and to the Vietnamese men?
Not this time. There was the higher level, the bigger the city, the more of that there was. There was little to none. Major Ten wouldn't have it.
Okay.
He ran his town, his district with an iron fist, and I'll tell you about his discipline in a minute.
Okay.
And he wouldn't have it, so there was none of that in Vien Bien City. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, one of my sergeants brought a girl in. Now, I don't know whether she was a prostitute or not, but she was
a Vietnamese girl.
Yeah, a Vietnamese girl. And the district chief, she stated me up. They said, don't do that. Don't allow him to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he wasn't really angry with me. Mm-hmm. He was angry with the sergeant. The girl was there before I even knew she was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a stop to that.
Okay.
But they were rather prevalent in Gong Kong City. Because the first province chief that was there, and he left right after Tet, they put in a new province chief. He was sorry. He was sorry. Like my acting district chief and Major Tim got wounded. But the bigger the city, the more, you know, in Saigon, they were very prevalent.
Right, right. Okay. Tell me about Major Ten's discipline.
Major Ten was a very stern disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
On one of the operations, we were going up this road here, up to Dong Toi, which is this little town here on this river.
Mm-hmm.
We had passed an outpost right in this area. We were up in here, which is a north-south route 21, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Major Tim didn't carry a rifle. He had a little snub-nosed 38 that he carried. He wanted to signal this outpost. Now, he had his 10 bodyguards with him.
Mm-hmm.
So he got a rifle from one of his bodyguards and put it on semi-automatic and fired around. And it fired, but it failed to eject. No, it ejected, but it failed to feed.
Okay,
you follow what I'm saying? It wouldn't feed another round in. Well, he fiddled with it and finally got another round in there and fired it again, and it did the same thing. It wouldn't feed. And his next move was like that. He hit that troop right in the chest with the butt of that weapon.
Mm.
He hit him with the weapon. He kicked him. He slapped him. And threw his weapon at him. And got another one. And it did the same thing. And he worked him over the same way. He had told those men, they had a 20-round magazine on. Unless you're in contact every day, you never fill that magazine completely full. Because it completely depresses the follower spring. And it loses its tension. And it won't feed properly.
Mm-hmm.
He had told them not to do that. Never put more than 18 rounds in a 20-round magazine.
Mm-hmm.
They had them stuffed full. And he told them, well, you see, they're way up here in the contested territory. And here we are, several kilometers. Said, you all walk back. You're not going back with me. You can't do any good.
Gosh.
So we drove back to the district headquarters. And when they got in, he took those guys, his house over here, district headquarters here. He had a garden over here, not a vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm.
He had a roof of sort over it. Mm-hmm. We had meals in his garden. But he put those troops on a hard, rocky ground over there, made them roll their sleeves up and do the low crawl for about 50 yards across and back. With his subordinate officers out there throwing rocks at him.
Oh my gosh.
He did not allow drinking or gambling. He had a rubber club, hard rubber, about this long.
About 2 feet?
About 18 inches.
Okay.
And it was about 2 inches wide and about an inch thick.
Okay.
And he caught someone breaking his drinking or gambling rule,
mm-hmm.
and he would bring him in his office and literally beat them with that club. I don't mean just tap them. Mm-hmm. I mean beat them. And then for the drinkers, he would take them out behind district headquarters, and there was a post in the ground, and he would tie them up to that post, have them tied up,
mm-hmm.
with their hands behind them, and hang a picture of a big bottle of booze around their neck. And they would stand there in the hot sun all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And the gamblers... And this Vietnamese sergeant that I've mentioned several times, mm-hmm. has been, he got caught in that, and the district chief whipped him pretty good at that club.
Hmm.
And he's one of the top
mm-hmm.
sergeants in the district.
Mm-hmm.
But they expected this. The people expected this. That when they screwed up and got caught, they knew they were going to be punished. If they weren't punished, mm-hmm. they would lose respect for him.
Of course.
And let me tell you something, friend. You don't make a false move toward that district chief when his troops are around, because they'd be on you like stink on puke.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon my French. They had that much respect for the man.
Okay.
He was their god, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And the guy who came in after him was nothing like this.
The acting district chief.
Mm-hmm.
And the next district chief, at least the time I had with him, although I liked him a lot,
mm-hmm.
he wasn't the strong disciplinarian like Major Tin was.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was just feeling his way through.
Mm-hmm.
And then within 2 or 3 months after he got there, I rotated out.
Okay. Tell me about Tet. What was Tet like for you?
We had gotten information at Tet of 1968 that there was going to be the big nationwide push.
Mm-hmm.
And as Tet approached, Major Tin's intelligence network in here,
mm-hmm.
had elements of 3 main force, VC main force battalions surrounding our little town here.
Mm-hmm.
And we were bottled up. We knew we couldn't get out. We heard later, after it was all over, that the a part of the big plan in Saigon,
mm-hmm.
was to capture the civilian radio station in Thai.
Mm-hmm.
And they would broadcast over that station, "We're in command, we're in control, throw down your arms," you know. Our people all had their little transistor radios.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, and that would just blow their mind completely. Also, this main force battalion, that was basically the main communication that they had. They were waiting on that broadcast, and then they would attack. That broadcast never came, because just before the radio station fell into the hands of the NVA, they managed to destroy the transmitters.
Mm-hmm.
So that broadcast never came. When the broadcast never came, they withdrew. The only real action in the province,
mm-hmm.
that night was the VC got into Gokong City and attacked the jail and released all the prisoners out of the province jail and withdrew.
Hmm. So relatively uneventful.
Very tense, but uneventful.
Right.
That was one of those times when I call it tension. It might have been stress, might have been both, but it was pretty thick.
Mm-hmm. You knew you were surrounded.
When Major Tin said we were surrounded, I had no doubt that we were surrounded.
Right.
Yeah, I knew we were surrounded.
And you guys were prepared to fight.
That's right.
And that's all you could do.
Yeah, we'll just fight. That's all.
And so the next day in the morning,
It was still pretty tense. We didn't know what all was going on. Mm-hmm. We didn't know who was where or mm-hmm. what. And then we just kind of sat fast and maintained our heightened alert status.
Mm-hmm.
And we never did get hit.
Hmm.
So that was my experiences during TET. TET is more meaningful to these people than Christmas is.
Mm-hmm.
My assistant and I went around throughout the town that night. We went to our houseboy's house.
Mm-hmm.
We knew where he lived. And by the way, he was a PF soldier. But his only job was to take care of the mm-hmm. advisors. Mm-hmm. But we went to his house, and he seemed so pleased that we cared enough to come and visit him mm-hmm. on the tent.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
And we just visited and looked around the town. Mm-hmm. Oh, there was weapons shooting, fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
And, district chief allowed that one time.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, TET goes on for several days.
Right. What did you guys do for entertainment?
Watch television,
mm-hmm.
play dominoes with the Vietnamese.
Okay.
That was it primarily.
How about alcohol or drug use?
Drugs, no. I had some beer. I wished I'd drink beer because I sure did seem to like it, but I never did like beer.
You never did like it?
never did. So we could get beer at the commissary when they had it,
mm-hmm.
and we'd bring it in, cool it down.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my team would drink a beer.
Mm-hmm.
There was some hard liquor around. The Vietnamese love to do this. Here I'm a brand new district senior advisor,
mm-hmm.
and we're going out on operation tomorrow morning. But they want to have a party for the new American Colvin Mee.
Mm-hmm.
You know that term?
Mm-hmm.
That's American advisor. Okay, Colvin. So. My assistant and I went to this party,
mm-hmm.
and I think they had.
Well, anyway, it was.
I don't know whether it was scotch or just red whiskey. But anyway, mm-hmm. they wanted a toast to the senior advisor.
Mm-hmm.
One guy would toast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, try to take a little sip. Well, then this guy would want a toast. Okay, then this, and I finally said, no, no more. Not on this particular occasion, but there was another occasion. My assistant came home about three sheets to the wind.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Were there any tension amongst the Americans in your compound?
Yes. the radio operator that was there when I got there was a whiner. Bellyacre. He did not like our medic, who was a sergeant. He was a staff sergeant, E6.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost called his name. The sergeant was Sergeant Hedrick. But anyway, he had conflicts with Hedrick all the time. And I talked to him and I said, we've got to get along here. And if you don't do your part, then I'm going to have to run you off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, for a day or two, it'd be all right. Then he'd go right back to his old sullen cell. Mm-hmm. I just sent him up, took him up to go-kart. I told my boss, who I never did like, I don't want him. I'd rather do without him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you might not get another one for a while. I said, okay, I'll work without him. I don't want this guy. He's causing problems within the team.
Mm-hmm.
And I just left him there. And it wasn't too long before I got another. But
go ahead.
Generally, we got along real well.
Okay.
Like I say, I was the boss. They knew I was the boss. They knew that Captain Barrera was the assistant. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't have to stay up and say, I'm the major. We do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
We got along.
Right. How about between you and your immediate boss? You said you guys did not get along. Tell me about that.
This individual, and I won't call his name, he was a lieutenant colonel. He was a member of the Corps of Engineers. I don't know why. It seemed like if I ever went to him with a problem or a situation, he put me down. oh, you know, that's not, you can't do that, you know. Okay, sir, fine. Now, if I could get into the civilian, and I had two different civilian senior advisors, mm-hmm. if I could get into him, mm-hmm. we could talk. Now, it might wind up being the same thing, that the answer is no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. But the civilian had the tact to discuss it with me and not put me down, not try to make me feel like a fool. Mm-hmm. Where the colonel, that seemed like that's what he his primary interest was, to make me feel like a fool. Mm-hmm. And I just got to where I wouldn't have anything to do with him. When I'd go to GOCON, I wouldn't even go see him unless I had to.
Mm-hmm. Did that affect your actions in the field at all?
No, not at all. I ran into a situation there that I'd run into once before. This Colonel Ruth that I was talking about, he was the operations officer as a major at GOCON headquarters. Mm-hmm. Well, when the colonel left, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel and he became the senior advisor. He and I crossed horns once. We had some pretty good intelligence that there was some bad guys down here in the Coconut Grove. Mm-hmm. And so I called GOCON mm-hmm. and talked to, he was still a major then, Major Ruth. Is there any way, can we get some, any armed helicopters coming, put a strike in down here? You know, we've got some pretty good, no, we're not going to put in any strike down there. Yeah, that intelligence is not any good. There's not even one down there. You're not going to, you know, just on and on mm-hmm. and on. And I'm sorry if I'm talking too loud. And I that made me mad. And I went right to Major Tim, was still there, and I went to him, and he could see I was mad. I said, is there any way I can get you to GOCON? This guy is running over me, and he doesn't have any right to do that. Mm-hmm. He's not in the chain of command. Mm-hmm. And Major Tim said, well, now, there hasn't been a road clearing operation today. The road is not really open, but he said, I know it's clear. You can go. Man, I went in there, and I almost jumped on the colonel's desk that was still there, mm-hmm. and I just blew my stack. Who is the senior man down? Who's the senior advisor down there? Is it me or is it him? If it's him, put him down there and put me somewhere else. Mm-hmm. He has no right. Oh, now calm down, Major Wright. Calm down. You know, I'll take care of that. Oh, that was the only time that I ever got a satisfactory answer from that colonel. Mm-hmm. And then he left, and Major Root got promoted and became my boss.
So it didn't work out too well for you.
I had a similar situation in Germany.
Oh, yeah?
The battalion executive officer, and I'm a company commander, mm-hmm. and he's trying to tell me how to run my company, and I said, no, sir, it's not going to be that way. It's going to be this way. Mm-hmm. Well, the battalion commander left, and he became the battalion commander.
Tell me about Major 10. This guy seemed to have some really good inside information. Was he connected at all with the VC?
Not at all.
How did he know all this information?
He had developed his intelligence network over the years when he was there. He spent a lot of time with the families of his people. Mm-hmm. And his people's families knew that if something happened to their husband or son, that Major Ten would take care of them. Mm-hmm. And you'll see in the slides, there's pictures of big Christmas parties mm-hmm. in the district headquarters mm-hmm. where the chief brought in all his families and he'd give them presents, the kids presents, and he had his civilian staff that worked in the district headquarters out giving out mm-hmm. gifts and mm-hmm. presents, and he would take care of them, and they knew he would take care of them. Mm-hmm. He had developed this rapport with them over the year, mm-hmm. and they worshipped the ground he walked on. Mm-hmm. So it was a process of over the years that he had worked with and developed.
Right. Okay. Did you ever experience any racial issues?
None. Not a one.
Between the American troops and then also the American troops and the Vietnamese civilians?
No. I had, my assistant was Captain Barrera, mm-hmm. Mexican-American. He was raised down on the river.
Rio Grande.
Okay. I had a Mexican-American sergeant. He's the one that brought the girl in. Mm-hmm. Had a black sergeant. Mm-hmm. And there was, we were brothers. We were family. Mm-hmm. And we literally loved each other. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you see, but I wasn't with any high-density Americans.
Right.
Of five Americans is about the most that was ever there at any one time.
Right. Tell me about these relationships that you form with these men.
That's strange. That as I think about that, it was very close there. Mm-hmm. But when you rotated out, your life went somewhere else. Their life was still there. Mm-hmm. You had basically no contact with them. Mm-hmm. I have not had any contact with any of the people on my team mm-hmm. since I left Vietnam.
Really?
None. But it's a big army. It's a big world.
Right.
And there was only four other people than me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you don't even know if they survived or not?
To the best of my knowledge and belief, all of the Americans that I was real close to survived. Mm-hmm. Now, some of, at least one of my real close Vietnamese friends, a young lieutenant, second lieutenant, mm-hmm. Spoke real good English. Mm-hmm. He spent a lot of time at my house. In fact, the night of the night after the mortar attack on the mm-hmm. town that took out the district chief, his wife, he had brought his wife over to visit with us too. I was teaching her English. Mm-hmm. She couldn't get out. They had closed down the compound, so she spent the night there. He spent a lot of nights in my house. He would just fall out there on our couch and go to sleep. We'd go back to our beds. Mm-hmm. But she spent the night in our house that night. He, shortly after I left, my replacement wrote me a letter and said that his name was Mend. Lieutenant Mend, on an operation. He was the PF platoon leader. So we brought in PF company commander. We brought in three of our PF platoons to make a PF company. Mm-hmm. And he was the commander. And Min was a cocky little guy. He was a young man. Mm-hmm. And he was cocky and he just, he careless. And he got into a booby trap and killed him. Mm-hmm. And that hurt.
Yeah.
That hurt. I would love to know what happened to the sergeant. The first lieutenant, the number two man in the district,
mm-hmm.
Major Tim, Major Sean. I'd love to know what happened to them. When I went back the second tour, mm-hmm. I did some research to see if what was going on down here. Mm-hmm. They had done away with the advisory team in the districts. There was a small advisory team still in GOCON. So I didn't even attempt to go down there. I wanted to, if there'd still been an advisory team down here, mm-hmm. I was going to try to get down there and spend a day or two down there to, mm-hmm. Just to see what was going on, mm-hmm. see if there was any of the Vietnamese still mm-hmm. around that I knew.
But you didn't?
Never did get down there.
Were you able to take any R&Rs while you were in country?
First tour, I went to Hawaii and met Gail in Hawaii, and that was lovely.
Yeah.
Needless to say. Uh-huh. Second tour, and the only time with five children that I went off and left my wife pregnant. 71, 72, and our fifth child was born January the 13th of 1972. But I came home for Christmas. I took 14 days leave, mm-hmm. and came home and was there for Christmas. We was hoping the baby would be born early to mid-December, but he decided to wait until mid-January.
So you missed that. You were back in the country.
Yeah, I was back in country when that fifth child came. But I thought that was pretty amazing that we had, actually only had four children in the military, and I was only absent for one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that is amazing. How about USO shows? Were you ever able to attend?
Not this tour.
Okay.
I heard about some the second tour, and I believe it's Jack Benny.
Mm-hmm.
But I just didn't feel like I wanted to fight the crowd, and I just didn't go.
Okay. Was it in Saigon?
Yeah.
Okay.
It might have been. See, I wasn't in Saigon per se. There's Long Bend Post,
mm-hmm.
Which is, and I can't even tell you what, you know, how close it was. See, it wasn't far from Saigon, but it wasn't in Saigon proper. Mm-hmm. And that's where USRV, United States Army Vietnam, headquarters was located.
Mm-hmm.
Second largest headquarters in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And we got the information that that this USO show was coming, and I just didn't feel like fighting the crowd, so I didn't go. And that's the only one that I know of.
Okay.
The closest thing to a USO show in 67, 68 was Christmas of 67.
Mm-hmm.
A chaplain and two, I believe they were Red Cross women,
mm-hmm.
came down to visit us on Christmas Day.
The Donut Dollies?
No. They weren't the Donut Dollies.
Okay.
They might not. They were with Red Cross, I'm sure. But anyway, they just came down to visit, and they brought, you know, Red Cross type gifts, mm-hmm. so that we, the team, would have some Christmas gifts, and the chaplain had a little devotional, and we prayed together, you know, mm-hmm. and it was. And I won't say any more because I get a little misty over that.
Okay.
But it was neat. It was neat. We had a grand Christmas thing.
You want to talk about it?
I can.
Okay.
For our, other than this, this was good.
Mm-hmm.
But we talked about it, and we wanted to have something special, mm-hmm. This Christmas. So we got some commodities. I don't remember, 50-pound bags of bulgur wheat,
mm-hmm.
and cooking oil and some other things. And we coordinated this with Major Tim, the district chief. And we went out to an area, and people came in, and we would give them these things as our Christmas to them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what Christmas was.
Right.
And Captain Barrera, my assistant, mm-hmm. had a Polaroid camera. And he would take a picture when we were giving it to them,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd give them a picture.
Oh, how neat.
Oh, they loved that. Well, he had just about run out of film.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had two snaps left. And one old gentleman, one of the older gentlemen that we'd given the stuff to, we didn't take his picture. And he went to the district chief. So we took his picture,
mm-hmm.
with the district chief. We took his picture. Yeah, we took his picture with the gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And then the district chief was handing him the picture, and we took that picture.
Hmm.
He was just happy as a pig in slop. I mean, that old man was so fun.
Uh-huh.
But that was so meaningful to us, because we were doing something without any reciprocation.
Right.
You know, we didn't expect, we didn't want, we wanted to give.
Mm-hmm.
And so we gave them of what meager little things that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a great Christmas.
That's good. Were you able to ever make any Mars calls back to Gale?
Not this time.
Okay.
That wasn't available to us. I don't even know that Mars was up at 67, 68.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I talked to her several times, second tour.
Okay.
I made a long distance call. I called through the Saigon operator to the West Coast. She was in Killeen, Texas at that time, and talked to her through,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty expensive for those times.
So,
I don't remember what it cost. Probably in some of those letters that mm-hmm. are right there, that I know in one of them I asked her what it cost, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But I get Mars and those calls, and then I can't remember what the other system was called, but I talked to her several times. Second tour,
okay.
The first tour was absolutely no contact, with the exception of the letters in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. How often would you get these letters back from her? I mean, was the mail service pretty reliable?
As a matter of fact, no, because of the tactical situation,
uh-huh.
we couldn't get to town get to go call that often. Mm-hmm. And our mail came through Mito, which was somewhere over in this area, mm-hmm. and it would get hung up there for several days. So it would go, the best I ever got was a four-day turnaround. I mm-hmm. say four-day turnaround. Her dated letter got to me 4 days later.
Okay.
And I don't know what was the shortest time she got. It'd go anywhere from 4 days to 10 days.
Okay. Would you like to take a lunch break?
I guess.
Okay. Okay, we'll end it right here.